Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction, a podcast where every week we address politics, geopolitics, economics and culture, looking at the stories that matter. The COVID inquiry has returned. At the time of recording, the first hearing of 2024 has begun, specifically looking into decision-making and governance in Scotland. Last week, Chair of the Inquiry, Baroness Hallett, announced an updated timetable for this year's hearings, postponing the summer's hearings on vaccines. To discuss all of that, I'm joined by someone who's taken a great interest in the subject and has campaigned throughout the COVID pandemic. Francis Hoare is an English barrister who specialises in public and administrative law. Right after the first lockdown in April 2020, he argued that lockdown regulations were incompatible with the European Court of Human Rights and has since commented on all other aspects of COVID-19 and its legal implications. Francis, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What's your perspective on the inquiry so far in terms of the lines of questioning that have been pursued by the inquiry's counsels? Indeed, how the whole thing has set up. How has it looked?
I think I'd start at the end there, or rather the beginning, really, how it's set up. We go back for that to the terms of reference. And the terms of reference were originally always set by the Prime Minister. And they are, after they were set, there was a consultation, or after the initial version was set, there was a consultation. A number of people, including me and other campaigning groups, responded to that consultation, and then they were fixed. It's not necessarily unknown for those to be challenged, but there was no challenge to them. I mean, challenged by way of an administrative judicial review of that decision in relation to what was under the terms of reference. The big difficulty for me with the terms of reference is that they don't focus primarily on what I think has to be the main reason for the inquiry and the main objective in considering matters, which is the decision to lock down and whether or not that was the right and proportionate decision to make. It was a decision that was totally unprecedented. Anything of that nature is unprecedented in modern history, certainly. And it was also contrary to all pandemic plans up to 2020, and that included, for what it is worth, a pandemic plan that was written by the WHO only in 2019. Mm. The flu pandemic plan, which also considered other pandemics, coronavirus pandemics, specifically referred to SARS, which is a coronavirus, in page 15, for what it's worth, that was all advising against even much less stringent measures. And the point there is in addition, another factor, another thing that the inquiry didn't do was, or the terms of reference didn't do, was to ask for the inquiry to consider whether and to what extent those plans were followed. We've certainly seen some focus on contingencies and stocks and hospital places, which is part, but only a part, of that contingency planning, because the planning wasn't just about how you deal with those contingencies. It was about the global government reaction. Any restrictions that the government would or could impose, any measures requiring infected people to be quarantined, and their efficacy. And they weren't just plans. They weren't just plans. They were assessments of the evidence. The UK plan, which was continually updated, contained a number of assessments of evidence, and so did the WHO plan. So you would think that the first thing to consider by the inquiry would be, did we follow the pandemic plans? If not, why not? Were the pandemic plans fit for purpose? Now, that's not completely outside the terms of reference, but it's been very far from the focus of the inquiry so far. And of course, secondly, and obviously very much a part of that element, is were we right? How were we right to lockdown? But perhaps before that, and a part of that question is how did we come to that decision? And there's been precious little scrutiny of that. The Prime Minister of the day, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the former Prime Minister, the Prime Minister at the time, have both been given evidence to the inquiry, and neither have really, the Council of the Inquiry and Baroness Howlett simply haven't examined in any proper detail that question.
Why is that, do you think? Why are the terms of reference structured as they are? Do you think it's deliberate? Is it a deliberate decision to try and avoid confronting that fundamental question that you describe, or is it rooted in misunderstanding?
It's clearly deliberate to the extent that the terms of reference have been drawn up and consulted about, and decisions have been made about what should be included and what shouldn't be included, both at the initial stage and after the consultation, considering the consultation, many of the responses included made that point. So, yes, it's deliberate in that sense. Is it a deliberate attempt to obscure the central question? I think perhaps, yes, it is. And I say that because the government and government agencies have, since 2020, really, been extremely reluctant to engage in that central question. And they've been much happier engaging with the, I have to say, fanatics on the other side, who say that the reaction by the UK should have been even more extreme. The zero COVID proponents, Independent Sage, which is full of people like that. And that's ground that the government is happy dealing with and not conceding. But that's that moves Ockham's razor, as it were, very, very far away from what it would have been conventionally before 2020, or even right up until the early months of 2020. And it assumes what has never been assumed before, which is that this is a kind of reaction which is normal. I think one of the reasons for that is that that is a perception that's become ingrained into the public consciousness through the media, particularly. And the media obviously feeding to a large extent the government line, scrutinising it when it wasn't tough enough as they saw it, but giving very little scrutiny, most of the media in a way, very little scrutiny to anything else, and particularly the broadcast media, which has such a huge effect on public consciousness, particularly when people are locked in their homes, not effectively locked in their homes, and watching television all the time, watching the BBC and ITV and so on. And therefore, even people who were normally pretty critical, or you would think would be pretty critical, don't seem to engage with the question in that way, which is the primary question. The overwhelming question must be, why did we do this? Now, we may or may not have been right to, I happen to think we were extremely, it was extremely wrong thing to do, but if you are to have an inquiry and if you are to investigate, that's got to be central, hasn't it?
It seems sensible to try and get to the heart of that question, try and answer it. I mean, why do you think it happened, if the inquiry is not going to answer that question, why that policy decision was taken to abandon the planning that had already taken place and to, on the hoof, implement a new ad hoc, much more draconian plan? If someone was from the government in that period who took those decisions was here, they would say, look, we didn't know what we were dealing with. They would say, this was a new kind of phenomenon, and they had to improvise public policy on the hoof. Is that fair, do you think, or was it panic, or was it to do with the personalities involved, or was there also an element of international groupthink that, as you saw this unfold in Italy, initially dismissed by some people in the UK government because it seemed to be happening a long way away, and then there is this pickup moment where they think, good Lord, the UK is going to have to act very, very quickly. Is it understandable how it happened?
That's one reason why it's so important that the inquiry does investigate that question, and so sad that it doesn't seem to be interested in doing so. I think the first point to make is that it's a known unknown, in that, to use a sort of Donald Rumsfeld-ism, rather than unknown unknown, in that it was always known that we were likely to have some form of pandemic flu or coronavirus at some stage. That was Dr. Lucy Eustope, for example, is a leading disaster specialist.
Who wrote a very good book on that subject.
Indeed. Has said that it was the number one known unknown that we were facing. That's not the word she used, but it's the number one potential crisis, disaster, natural disaster, which is, I suppose, what it is, facing the government as a risk, and a number one risk. And therefore, that planning was inevitably, the planning and the research was inevitably looking at possibilities and speculating about exactly what the virus might be. Now, I of course, we've had controversy about the origins of the virus, and now it seems to be much more accepted that it may well have a lab origin. But which, something that was very much pushed off the agenda by Fauci and many other, and the Wellcome Trust and many others back in the day. So yes, people didn't know exactly what they were dealing with, but they never would in a pandemic situation. The whole point of those plans is to say, well, look, you will have an unknown. You will be looking into it. You won't know exactly what it is. But what we do know is, in respect of respiratory viruses, we have a wealth of evidence about the efficacy, the effectiveness of various different measures going back over 100 years, but certainly in terms of modern science, 100 years or so. And we can measure and know how effective these different types of measures are. And in addition to that, critical to the government's thinking and also critical to the WHO's advice as recently as I say, in, as 2019, was to emphasise the need for normality, because the central crisis and tragedy that any government is looking at on a day-to-day basis is people would be dying from the pandemic itself. But what they have to be aware of, and what all the pandemic plans said they must be aware of, is the risk that the reaction to it, firstly, may not be very effective anyway, so it may not actually save lives, and secondly, even if it is effective, and to the extent that it's effective, it will have negative consequences, and those need to be reviewed.
Yeah, of the many extraordinary things which happened in that period, it still surprises me, and the inquiry doesn't seem interested enough in this question, is how could it be that this intervention, which is essentially to close schools and to lock in an entire generation of school pupils, that cost and the inevitable damage in terms of mental health and the adverse impact felt disproportionately by the poorest, without access to necessarily to outside space and locked in sometimes in very difficult circumstances, to say nothing then of the loss of time at school and the educational cost, that doesn't anywhere in the system seem to have played a part. There doesn't seem to have been a moment where the biologists and virologists weighed that up alongside colleagues from Department of Education or from the planning community. No one seems to have said, okay, so you get this gain supposedly in terms of slowing the spread, but the calculation must be that for every month of schooling lost, this will be the human and economic cost. That didn't happen.
Yes, and when I pointed out this to friends as well as publicly, I was said, of course the government will be considering these matters. It will be factoring in cost benefits and analyses. But the longer we went on, the more it became plain that at the initial apex, that moments in February and March where critical decisions were being made, barely any consideration was given to what must be the central to any government decision or any executive decision, which is balancing harms, because all decisions effectively balance harms, particularly important ones. And really, that's the job of a government to do that. And it's an abdication of responsibility not to. You talk about virologists. Well, virologists can really only give one opinion about their area. It's interesting for what it's worth, if just looking at the scientific perspective, that initially SAGE had no immunologists on it, which is pretty extraordinary considering the fact that the extent of immunity and the growth of immunity is a hugely important factor when you consider how quickly a virus will spread and how effective measures will be. But putting that to one side, you obviously need to have good expertise about the effect of all of these measures and to take them into account when making all these decisions. You might remember that when Boris Johnson was in hospital, which was probably an unfortunate part of this, not just from the sort of PR perspective, but also because of the lack of focus in the government, Dominic Raab effectively took over as First Minister, and he was the one who announced the famous five tests. Now, the five tests, if you remember, were about the tests that would be applied when restrictions, before deciding whether or not to reduce restrictions, all of them related to viral spread, every single one. It was quite extraordinary. It was as though the other factors, the other considerations didn't matter at all. And that's a way of decision making that would be appropriate, perhaps, if the country was being invaded in a world war. But in almost any other circumstances, it couldn't possibly be the appropriate way to make a decision, particularly when the harms were so well known. And I say so well known, not just because people were talking about them at the time. If anyone bothered to listen, people like Carol Sikora is talking about cancer. I was talking about, and Jonathan Sumption more particularly was talking about the effect on the constitution and on law. Many other people were talking about the effects on the economy and, of course, on children. So yes, it may not have been broadcast by the BBC, but many people were saying that at the time. But that was known about before. It was a known, these harms.
Do you
not
think
just a known unknown?
Do you think that there is embarrassment now?
Oh,
it is fascinating to watch people back away from the policy who were in favour of more extreme versions of the policy. So, for example, since the turn of the year, the Labour Party has announced a policy programme attempting really to try and make up the lost ground from that COVID generation, particularly, as I said, pupils from poorer backgrounds who've been adversely affected. So that's aimed at trying to tackle the long-term absence problem, the way in which those pupils have fallen behind. Now, that comes from a party that, in common with the government, was in favour of closing schools for very long periods, and indeed critics of Labour have pointed out that Labour was demanding even tougher measures. And certainly before the second full shutdown of schools, Labour was urging on the government and saying that the government was being far too slow to announce a full closure. It's interesting that Labour's education spokesman Bridget Phillipson has been brave enough to start to talk about this, but it's still cloaked a little bit in embarrassment, isn't it? There, no one really involved at the time, now still in a prominent position in politics, has come out and fronted up on this question, have they?
No, and when they do talk about it, they talk about it as though it was caused inevitably by the pandemic. So they say that the effect of the pandemic, which is a classic way to describe this, well, it wasn't the pandemic that closed schools. Now, it may or may not have been a justifiable reaction to it, but it was a reaction to it nevertheless, and it was one made, it was one caused by the government. But when I say the government, let's not forget that Labour's allies in the trade unions, and I say allies because, of course, the Labour Party is still a trade union party. Trade unions part of its constitutional makeup and an important part of it. The educational trade unions played an enormously important role in closing down schools in January.
It's in January 2021.
But also back in March. But in March, they were probably one of a number of different factors, albeit an important one. But in January, they were a hugely important factor. And Boris Johnson, in his classic Johnsonian way, was all for, at one stage, not closing schools, but it didn't take very much to push him into a different decision. And the point about schools is, of course, they're centrally important to children and their future, but they also make an impact, and the closure of schools has an impact on the rest of life, because if children have to be at home, then it becomes much more difficult for the economy to function. And that includes with parents working from home, if they're having to homeschool their children, a responsibility that the state before was thought to have taken up. And so that had an important consequence. And so I link it back to Labour because, as I say, they're a trade union party and they were very much backing the trade unions, who perhaps atypically, if we look at the way the trade unions, the educational trade unions operate so often, were looking for what they perceived to be the risks to teachers, but certainly not to children. And they barely paid lip service to children.
Realistically, was there an alternative policy available? And if there was, what would it have looked like?
Well, yes, and it would have looked like what we had always planned to do. You can look at Sweden as a direct comparison, but before you do, I would suggest that we look back at much more recent history. 1999-2000 is not considered as one of the big pandemics of the 20th century, but actually, if you actually look at the rate of total rates of death, particularly age adjusted, back in those in that area in December and January, and you compare it with what was a later in the year, but March, April, mainly April in 2020, and also, in fact, in the second wave in 2021, you will see striking similarities. Huge amounts of deaths of very elderly people in what was a pretty serious flu epidemic. If you think back to that, people sometimes who were adults at the time will remember there was a lot of illness about and people got very ill.
Remember it very clearly.
So it wasn't unmemorable, but it certainly didn't cause earth-shattering reactions. In fact, pretty much nothing happened in the sense of certainly not closing schools, very little advice to stay at home, perhaps advice to stay at home if you had symptoms and so on. And the earth didn't shatter. Yes, people died from that outbreak, but there were no adverse consequences. The economy continued to grow and so on. If you look back to 1950s and 1960s, where we had pandemics that are recognised as being serious, Hong Kong flu and Asian flu, in those two, Woodstock happened on one of them, the economy continued to grow. So simply cannot be said that the economy was devastated because of the pandemic and that this was inevitable, whatever reaction you had. Going back to the contemporary example of Sweden, Sweden actually had far more draconian measures than had ever been imposed, certainly since Spanish flu, and really only in the United States, certain parts of the United States, and perhaps Australia, were there really severe measures in Spanish flu. Nothing comparable to COVID-19 in the rest of the world. And look at Sweden. Its death rate at the time from COVID was comparable to other similar-sized economies, somewhat more than other Nordic countries, but its excess deaths between 2020 and 2022, the three, what might be called the three pandemic years, are lower even than its Nordic neighbours, which people always say when you mention Sweden, say, oh, well, Denmark and Finland and so on had much lower deaths. They didn't. But as a result of that, because it didn't close schools ever in person for any under 16s, it briefly closed them for what are misleadingly from an Anglophone audience called high schools, but in fact that actually means sixth form, 16 plus. It closed them for 16 pluses for a very short time. I don't think it did at all in 2021. And it never closed any businesses on a general basis and required bar service in pubs and so on. And that was a much more proportionate reaction. And it was a reaction that was grounded in sense and also removed from the political hurly-burly, because under the Constitution, the health advisors are responsible for it. Now, I personally have qualms about that, because I don't really think we should be delegating decisions of that importance to health professionals. Also, if we did in this country, it would certainly not have looked like Sweden, because we didn't have somebody like Tegnell in office, unfortunately. But that is the obvious example, and an example that worked very well. And then in the United States, obviously, you have Florida, and Florida had a far better excess death total than California, which has a much younger population than Florida, and it's similar sort of climate.
How did you get into this? I mean, go back to early 2020, 4 years ago, the pandemic is about to happen. What sort of frame of mind were you in as it started? Did you assume, as some of us did, I mean, I certainly did, that it was a good idea to have a relatively decent amount of faith in authority and British pandemic planning and the institutions of the state? While I'm skeptical about governments, I thought, right, at the heart of it, the heart of this machine will be people who really know what they're doing. What was your frame of mind then, and how did it evolve? How did you become more and more concerned about the way policy was developing?
I had very little involvement professionally or personally with anything like pandemic planning before 2020, and some health related cases, but not really relating to flu or to the Public Health Act in the way that it is operates on a more daily basis, with quarantines for very severely infected people and so on, which is something that magistrates can do generally. And I think you're probably right that with your reservations, similar reservations to you probably, I had a certain amount of faith in the government machine, albeit I'd seen its inefficiencies at quite close quarters, doing with a sort of public law background, and also going back much further in my early years in crime, practicing in crime. So I didn't come to it with a kind of perspective on what we should or shouldn't do, but I did come to it with an interest in history and general awareness of historical precedent. And so it certainly wasn't my assumption that what we would do would be, firstly, to follow a totalitarian power like China, and secondly, to do something which had not been attempted in anything like that form since the early modern period in the 17th century, and even then, not in as an extreme form, and for plague, which is just a completely different thing to flu or coronavirus pandemics. So I had what I assumed to be the reaction that everyone would have, but I don't think I really answered your question a few questions ago about why did this reaction happen. And I think you encapsulated a number of reasons why it did, which all of which have some are true to some extent. And I think the snowball effect, the sort of international pressure, the panic, the fear that was being. At first, governments were not keen to popularise fear, but it was certainly being promoted by the media. And then I think as a result of the media, the pressure of the media caused the government to participate in this. And Laura Dodsworth obviously has written about that and others. And all of that led to a vast proportion of people seemingly accepting what, to me, always... it seemed quite extraordinary measures that would need extraordinary justification for a disease that, yes, was serious. But even by March, we could see that it was one that massively disproportionately affected the very old and the very sick. And the conventional means of dealing with that is, of course, to protect the very old and the very sick, and not to cut off the economy and change the way we live for a prolonged period.
Yeah. In 2022, you headed a judicial review case against the Secretary of State for Health concerning COVID-19 vaccinations, specifically for children.
Mm.
That case was ultimately dismissed, but what did that experience show about the government's powers during the pandemic?
It was really post-pandemic because the vaccine mandates and the vaccine mandates was another judicial review I did, but the children's recommendation happened firstly in September 2021. What that showed was that a proper procedure, which takes into account the precautionary principle in a proper way, that is to say, when there is limited evidence, you must proceed with caution, and in that sense, particularly where children are affected. And the precautionary principle was referred to and cited by the JCVI, the body advising government on vaccination, in July 2021, when they said, well, we simply don't know enough about the safety record of this vaccination, particularly affecting children and young people, to be able to advise in favour of it, particularly given that the virus itself is of low consequence to the vast majority of children. And by that time, they had already authorised and recommended it for vulnerable children. Back in September, fast forward to September, and their view had not changed on the safety data. But they then said, well, now we have to ask the chief medical officer because there are other social considerations. So the reasoning for the reason that advice changed, it didn't really change from the JCVI. They were at best neutral about it. In reality, it probably is right to say they advised that there would be such a small benefit for children that, taking into account the precautionary principle, it wouldn't be appropriate on a medical basis to advise vaccination. That's contestable because of the way they looked at the Pfizer trials and what they had revealed about the data and so on. But the reason the government eventually went for vaccination of children was under 16s first, and then I think it was 14 to or 12 to 15 year olds firstly, and then secondly later younger children. The reason they did so was supposedly because of absences, and that the absences would have been from COVID that might have been avoided because of vaccination. And this was in spite of the fact that growing numbers of children were getting infected anyway, and therefore would have a degree of natural immunity. That was known to increase at a huge, to a huge extent. It did increase to a massive extent by the end of 2021. And in addition to that, they failed to balance the likely absences from COVID against the likely absences from side effects from the vaccine. And we're not necessarily talking about serious side effects here. We're talking about side effects that could cause somebody to be ill for a day or so. Everyone was going to get the vaccine. Not everyone was going to get COVID, certainly not at the same time. And you'd expect cohorts at schools to get the vaccinated at the same time. So it's absolutely. And that was a central part of the judicial review, which ultimately was unsuccessful. But a central part of that was that the government simply didn't do that balancing act.
And what's the policy now? Because the fact that I'm asking this and that I haven't paid that much attention to vaccine policy this winter tells its own story. I think many of us will be in that situation, other than perhaps older people who've had a booster. But the advice now is effectively it's a booster for those over 65,
yep,
or those who are medically vulnerable in some other way.
Yes, that's right. And there's no recommendation for children to have vaccinations at the moment. Certainly there's no school program.
Is the logic of that people have already had so much of the vaccine, initial vaccinations plus boosters, that we all have fantastic immunity now? Not all of us, but many of us have immunity or have had it, as I've had it, you know, COVID, I think, three times, and been vaccinated once or no, twice. Is the logic there that just we're protected, or the disease has changed, or actually is it a tacit admission that you didn't need to vaccinate, for example, anyone under the age of 40? Other than someone with a vulnerable condition.
Yeah, well, I understand that the public reasoning is in part that there is so much more immunity, both natural immunity and vaccinated immunity, and secondly, that the virus has become so much less severe. In saying that, that was always a central... It wasn't just a point that those challenging vaccine mandates and authorising vaccinations for cohorts, certainly under 40s, arguably even under 50s, who largely were not at risk from COVID unless they had serious underlying conditions. It was also the case that it was always known, because it's an inevitable consequence of pandemics, that they are a pandemic because there's a new strain of a particular virus. It's not obviously new, but it's a new strain to which people have less immunity. People, generally speaking, have some form of immunity to flus and coronaviruses. Otherwise, it would be like smallpox in the Americas, in Colombian America, where people had no immunity and so they died of flu. So there's a residual immunity of some sort, but that becomes greater and therefore there are fewer people to infect, and also the strains of the virus become less serious, partly because it's easier to spread. A virus is better able to spread if it doesn't seriously injure or kill its cohorts, its hosts. And so that was a standard and knowledge and understanding of the approach to pandemic policy, which was turned on its head in 2020.
Sure. But an advocate of the policy at the time would say, look, the fact that it has faded, it's still out there along with other respiratory diseases, but the fact that it's not just faded away of its own accord, that the vaccination program as implemented was implemented absolutely correctly, and we're getting the benefit of it now.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't purport to be able to answer that as a lawyer, not a scientist. And when I spoke about the general approach to viruses, this is just a well-known general knowledge from history that we have that affects policy with good reason.
But do you think? But well, what do you think? There was an alternative policy again. I mean, similar to lockdown, in some ways more complicated. The issue is more complicated than lockdown. But was there an alternative policy that wasn't pursued? For example, vaccination for those over 45 or 50, but not below, other than in exceptional circumstances.
Well, I think absolutely central to this issue is the question of informed consent. And informed consent means that people have full knowledge about the medicine that they are having, and that includes vaccinations. It also involves, in my view, and I think this is the correct conventional view in law as well, in the common law, that you need to be aware of the risk to you from the disease or medical complication that you're trying to combat, because an analysis of risks and benefit can only happen if you're not only aware of the risks of the vaccine, but also that you're aware of the risk of the virus that it's aimed at combating. Now, if it was more widely known that for example, in the first 6 months of COVID, I think it's right to say that about 600 people under 60 in the whole of England and Wales who did not have serious underlying conditions died of COVID, for example, if that was widely known, and if people weren't propagating this suggestion that COVID doesn't discriminate, which it always did and did very heavily, then they would have had cause to question whether or not it was in their interests to get vaccinated, bearing in mind this was, in addition, a novel form of vaccination. mRNA vaccines had not been authorised before 2020. although the government will react, the MHRA will react and say, well, they went through a very speeded up authorization process, which took everything into account. The one thing they couldn't have had is time. And time is the only thing that will allow you to measure the risks of any medical product to a reasonable degree of reasonable certainty, because you're just not going to know the long-term effects. And in fact, lo and behold, in 2021, it did become apparent that one side effect was myocarditis, and that's accepted by the JCVI. The extent of myocarditis and the extent of the risk is disputed, but there's no doubt it is a risk of much more to boys and young men than it is to other cohorts of the population. Now, were parents given information about that? Were young men or boys who had Gillick competence given that information to allow them to make informed decisions with informed consent? I don't think so. Were the materials that were provided to schools sufficient to give parents or Gillick competent, i.e. a person under 16 who has the sufficient maturity to make a medical decision for himself or herself, were they given sufficient information? I really don't think so. And I think that the whole reaction of the state to the virus and the fact that there was a lockdown was a big factor in making people far more afraid of the virus than they should have been. And in fact, there were surveys in either late 2020 or early 2021 about how many people the population thought had died of COVID. And there were absolutely extraordinary answers, particularly, I think, in Scotland, I remember, which perhaps reflect the degree of fear that the population had. Answers like 1% of the population, or even more than 1% of the population, which was miles away from the reality, and a lack of understanding about the fear to them and the risk to them. And that all factors into informed consent, because if you're being asked to have a vaccine for a medical condition that you think is far more serious than it is, how are you able to give informed consent to it? It'd be like a doctor saying, this is the risk of chemotherapy, but not telling you that you perhaps didn't have, that cancer hadn't spread sufficiently to justify it. Or that might not be a good example, but there are other many examples you can think of when a surgeon or a physician will give you advice about medical treatment, where that surgeon or the doctor will absolutely have to tell you about the risks to you from the disease, or from not amputating, or from not doing a particular procedure. That's elementary.
When you look back at the height of the pandemic, what do you think happened to people? I mean, I'm thinking particularly of COVID radicalization. A lot of focus of radicalization on the anti-lockdown side, which was criticized at the time, and there has been extreme radicalization on that side of the argument. But on the what was seen as the mainstream side of the argument, the pro-lockdown part of the argument, where some people were suggesting, some of them were leaders of countries, that policy didn't go nearly far enough. Nicola Sturgeon, Ardern in New Zealand, certainly their supporters, and talked about a concept of zero COVID and getting to a point where the disease could be completely eradicated. The rules, which were draconian but were somehow not draconian enough for certain people. What do you think was going on mentally there?
Again,
fear? Is it driven by fear?
I wonder whether it was for all of those leaders. If one were being charitable, one might say, yes, they genuinely feared for the outcome. They genuinely thought that there was a need to follow effectively China, because they were the first country to lock down, and their policies were highly influential in the WHO. And they did start this snowball effect, which I think is critical. Partly, I think it was politicians who enjoyed power and believe in the state. So I think there's a left-right element here. I think certainly politicians like Sturgeon and Ardern believe in the state, and perhaps even worse, Dan Andrews in Victoria in Australia, really believe in the state, really believe that the state is able to do good, and really believe that in certain circumstances it needs to tell people what to do because they know better. And in fact, Jacinda Ardern once said, "We are the purveyors of fact." She's actually on record. You can watch her saying this. You get your information from us. You don't get it. You don't do your own research. We will tell you what you need to know. She actually said that. It couldn't really get more Orwellian than that. And so, yes, I think that there were a certain people, and Susan Michie is an obvious example over here, but there were many others who enjoy the state having power, whether that they're wielding the power or other people are wielding it, because they believe that it makes decisions better than individuals. But I think the history of the 20th century and most centuries would suggest that that is very often not the case. And the more that the state believes it wields power for the greater good, the more it is to be feared, frankly. And that fear is justifiable, unlike the fear that the state was propagating. And again, to turn that on its head, the more it should be feared is when it uses fear to motivate people and to frighten people into doing things, because state power isn't just at the barrel of a gun. It's not just by enforcing prison sentences. Remember that none of the COVID offences were imprisonable, partly because they couldn't be, because they were done by secondary legislation, which only had the power to impose finable only offences. It wasn't necessary. The state has many other resources at its fingertips to make people behave in a certain manner. And all of them were used to great effect, not least its power over the broadcast media when it can dominate the headlines, dominate the broadcast media by having press conferences at 5 o'clock, staffing them with scientists so it looks very official, and people pay more attention to them than they do to politicians, at the same time telling people they needed to stay at home so they inevitably had nothing else to do but to watch these broadcasts. This all created a pressure cooker that built up this state of fear and motivated people to behave. And that had, as I said earlier, that had a huge effect over the next few years, not just months, and will have a huge impact on the way people think back over those years, because it's all too common for people to say, well, back in the pandemic, and as though this was a normal, expected way of behaving when there's a pandemic, even though up until 2020, they would never have thought in that way, and they'd never have had that consciousness.
Final question. We know, I think Lucy Easthope, who you mentioned, who's a disaster planner, written a very interesting book on the subject, I think she points out that if you look at the strike rate on serious diseases that might become pandemics, there's very roughly, there's one every 7 or so years that might turn into what biologists sometimes call the one. And track back the history of the last few decades, there have been 3, and one was the one in terms of provoking this extraordinary global reaction and being a very serious disease. So the chances are that something similar is coming at some point, either in the next 3-4 years or at some point in the next couple of decades. Our societies will be faced with similar choices. What needs to change, do you think, in terms of the approach adopted by leaders and governments? Is there anything institutional that needs to change, or is there something we can do to encourage politicians to think differently and in a more balanced way about it? What can be done?
That's a really good question. I would say they need to obviously go back to where they were before 2020 and look in an evidenced way on the effect of their decisions, but both on the virus they're aiming to control and also on the effects that their measures have. And that's how the evidence, that's the evidence way in which they used to look at things. We now have a wealth of information about the effect, the efficacy and the harms of the measures in the last few years. And the inquiry is a good place to look at them, although I fear it's not really doing that. But I think the broader issue is that we need a change of outlook in how we relate to risk and to health and to how we value our freedom and our economic liberties and our society in a broad sense. It would be difficult to think that there was any time that your ability to just meet up with your friends, even in your own house, was put in jeopardy by the state. And to value that as much as we value, as much as we fear for our health and we fear from what the state will do. You said at the start, I wrote about the what I saw as the unlawfulness of the initial measures, the first judicial review I was involved in was challenging the first lockdown. But there were constitutional protections in this country and in others, pretty much every country in the world, that could have been used by the judiciary on a case being brought, as they were in many jurisdictions, to clip the wings of the state. But they weren't, which again shows that it doesn't matter how well you craft constitutional protections, whether they be from the European Convention of Human Rights or from a British Bill of Rights or the American Constitution, Spanish Constitution, whatever it might be, they will always be as powerful as the judges who interpret them. And unfortunately, the judiciary in this country and in most other countries, almost all other countries, were extremely unwilling to go against a very powerful state when that decision might, particularly when that decision might be very unpopular. And that, I think, is an answer to those who say the answer to all our questions is to have a perfectly formed constitution and to have protections, and whether that be from Europe or whether that be homegrown or whatever it might be. You have to recognise that ultimately we're governed and we are judged by human beings, and that our governance is only as good as the people who are in charge or are sitting as judges. And I don't necessarily say good, I say strong-minded also, and willing to stand against the crowd. And unfortunately, what 2020 showed is that we were governed by people who were not willing to stand against the crowd, who were not willing to be unpopular, with very few exceptions. I mentioned Tegnell. I wonder whether in 1980s, if this had happened under Margaret Thatcher, I rather hope and believe that she would have reacted in a very different way, not just because she was a scientist and she understood these things, and not just because she valued liberty, but because she was also extremely tough-minded and diligent and hardworking. And that, I think, is something that we seem to have lost from our political class, particularly in this country. And so I think there are very... there are very sober lessons to be drawn from this, and none that are being answered anytime soon, I think.
Francis Hall, thank you very much for joining us on the Reaction podcast. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. We couldn't do the work we do at Reaction without your support. If you're not a subscriber, then consider becoming one for £8 a month or £80 a year. You get my weekly newsletter for Reaction subscribers on politics, geopolitics, economics, culture. You get the excellent Reaction daily briefing from our team of journalists, keeping you up to date on the stories that matter, and some of the best commentary around from columnists including Adam Bolton, Tim Marshall, and Maggie Pagano. Until next time, thank you for listening.